is with much pleasure that I introduce you Professor William Hatcher.
Whoops. I have here the materials that I promised you yesterday. I've given copies to several people yesterday. I would ask that you not take a copy if you already have one, if there are extras at the end. Those can be made available. So it would be helpful if you could bring this to the course each day, because I'll be referring to quotations and from the writings that are contained in here. It will make it easier if you do that. But of course, as in all things, especially in the faith, this is between the individual and his conscience. So, does everybody have a copy? Is there anyone who does not have a copy? The human race inherits a history of injustice. This is the reality of where we are. We can say that the Baha'i Faith, and in particular the Kitab-i Aqdas, contains an analysis and understanding of our history and appreciation for the current condition of the human race, a vision of the ultimate future of the human race, and finally, a program for effecting the transition from the present configuration to that future vision. So let me repeat that. It contains an analysis of the past, an analysis of the present condition, a vision of the future, and a program or a process for the transition for attaining that future vision, beginning with the current configuration as analyzed by Baha'u'llah. Now, the Kitab-i Aqdas and all of the Baha'i writings view religion as the fundamental relationship of human existence. Religion, true religion, is a relationship between God, the highest thing in existence, and the human being, which is the highest thing in creation. In other words, in the passage which Dr. Danish read last night, from page 65 of the Gleanings, which is quoted in part in this material that I've given you, Baha'u'llah says that everything in creation reflects some attributes of God, but only the human being reflects to some extent all of the attributes of God. So this amounts to a logical definition of the human being. You know, history of philosophy shows a succession of attempts, some of them rather comical, to define the human being. The beginning, the Greeks defined the human being as a featherless biped. And of course, then some wag observed that a plucked chicken satisfies this definition. And therefore, there's no difference between a human being and a plucked chicken if we take this definition. Well, this is obviously a very superficial definition of the human being, and trying to define the human being in a physical term. Aristotle did somewhat better than that. He said that the human being was a rational animal. But of course, we know from the Baha'i faith that the human being is not an animal in the first place. And in the second place, rationality is only one of the defining attributes of the human being, not the only one. It's certainly a very major one. And that's why I say that Aristotle did much better than others. But still, it's inadequate as a definition of the human being. But here, Baha'u'llah gives us, in this passage in the Gleanings, which Dr. Danish read last night, he gives us a logical, spiritual definition of the human being. The human being is that creature, that created being of God, which has the capacity to reflect to some extent, because it's not perfectly, but to reflect to some extent every attribute of God. And he says in this passage, Baha'u'llah goes on to say, alone among all created things hath man been singled out for so great a favor, so enduring a bounty. And so this is then a definition of the human being. A definition of something is what? A defining attribute of something is an attribute of the thing which singles out that thing from all other things in existence. Okay? This is something we can discuss in more detail later on. For example, we could define, say, the city of London, England. We could say the city of London, England is the capital city of England. Now that attribute of London singles out London among all other cities in the world. There's only one capital city of London, of England, excuse me. Now that doesn't define London in all of its totality. That doesn't tell you where it's situated, how many people are in it, what the class structure is, and so forth and so off. What is the cultural life there? There's an infinity of attributes of London that you cannot deduce in any way from just the fact that it is the capital city of England. But that one attribute, being the capital city of England, is a defining attribute of London. Another defining attribute would be to say, London is that city which is situated at such and such a latitude and such a longitude. In other words, geographically, you fix it. You determine where it is. That would also define London unequivocally. So we must distinguish between defining attributes and comprehensive attributes. Now, Baha'u'llah tells us that we can never give a comprehensive definition of God. But God has many defining attributes. God is the unique creator, right? There's only one creator, and God is that creator. God is the only uncaused cause, as Aristotle demonstrates and as Avicenna demonstrated. God is the only creator of human life on this planet. God is the only absolute being, the only perfect being, the only all-knowing being, and so forth and so on. So in other words, there are many defining attributes of God. And that's why I start with the example of something as banal as the city of London, just to show you that this fact of having a defining attribute does not limit the thing. It simply determines the thing from among all other things. As a matter of fact, not only can we not give a comprehensive definition of God, Abdu'l-Baha in some answered questions explained to us that we cannot give a comprehensive definition even of limited physical reality. In other words, the complexity of even a simple physical reality like this, like that table, we, the human being, cannot give a comprehensive definition of that thing. No matter how many attributes we say of it, we will never exhaust its attributes, because even this table has an infinite complexity when viewed in all of its dimensions, as modern physics shows us, for example. So, as it turns out, comprehensive definitions are possible only of abstract logical entities of the sort that exist in mathematics. So I'm not saying that this is a comprehensive definition of the human being, but it is a logical definition of the human being, which Baha'u'llah gives. Namely, the human being is that unique entity created by God and which has the capacity to reflect all of the attributes of God. Nothing else in creation has this capacity. Nothing else in creation, neither in the spiritual world, neither in the physical world, has that capacity to reflect all of the attributes of God. Now, let's examine this notion of reflection a little bit. So, just before I go on, let me say this. So, this then answers this age-old question of what is the human being? This gives a definition of the human being which can never be refuted or challenged. And notice that this definition of the human being defines the human being in his essence, because it is obviously conceivable that human life on other planets or in other systems could have in some ways a very different physical form. We can imagine, for example, that life could be based on something other than carbon. It could be based on silicon or something like that. So one could imagine that the physical human being could exist in another form. But the human being, these would be still be human beings in the very precise sense that they would have souls which have the capacity to reflect all of the attributes of God. I don't mean to suggest that I necessarily think that there are human beings in other bizarre forms. I'm simply pointing out that this definition of the human being as a spiritual reality defines the human being in his essence. It's a once and for all definition. It will always be true as true under all physical conditions that one could conceive and so forth. Now, let's think about what this means to reflect all of the attributes of God. Let's think what this means. Baha'u'llah teaches us to think of God as the sun, the source of light, and the attributes of God as the rays of the sun, the Holy Spirit. Now, we know that the rays of the sun, which appear in their pure form as white light, actually have an infinity of colors involved in them, the whole spectrum of colors. But this spectrum of colors, this infinity of different attributes, does not appear in the light in its pure form. In other words, when the light comes from the sun, when it's generated by the sun, it appears as a pure white light. There is no differentiation of attributes in the essence of God himself. This Abdu'l-Bahá makes very clear, beginning with the first tablet that Abdu'l-Bahá is known to have written, which he wrote at the age of 15, which is the commentary on the hadith, "I was a hidden treasure." And this tablet is the most philosophical of Abdu'l-Bahá's works. And very interestingly, the conditions under which this was written, I just mentioned this, historically it was in the Baghdad period. And one of the learned, he was not a mullah, but he was a learned man, came to Baha'u'llah, and he asked Baha'u'llah to elucidate this tradition, a hadith of Muhammad, in which Muhammad said, speaking in the voice of God, "I was a hidden treasure and desired to be known, hence I created thee." And Baha'u'llah said, the master will answer this. He immediately turned and said, the master will answer this. The master was 15 years old, whereupon Abdu'l-Bahá immediately sat down and composed this treatise. This treatise is in the most mature philosophical form. It is in every respect comparable to the most mature writings of Plato, of Aristotle, of Avicenna. And it in fact begins where the philosophical tradition of humanity ends at that point. In other words, it begins exactly at the summit of everything that came before the Baha'i Faith. And so those of us in the West who don't have access to all of the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, we tend to judge Abdu'l-Bahá's style from the general style of his talks, such as in Promulgation of Universal Peace. And we tend to think of his style as being somewhat general and sort of not very philosophical or scientific, and the way he talks about things in this very general, easy way. Though when you begin to examine, you realize there's a rigorous logic that underlies these things. But this was the more mature style of Abdu'l-Bahá. The original style of Abdu'l-Bahá represented a slightly more mature style than everything that had come before it. In other words, Abdu'l-Bahá started at the summit. The original style of Abdu'l-Bahá was the summit of everything that had gone before it, from beginning up until that point. And so the later works of Abdu'l-Bahá actually reflect a style which goes beyond everything that had come previously. So that's just an interesting sort of aside about this. And in this tablet, Abdu'l-Bahá explains that there is no differentiation of attributes within the essence of God. In other words, we cannot apply any attribute to God himself. Because to apply an attribute to God would be to say, in effect, that something pre-exists God. It is God who defines attributes, not attributes who define God. In other words, if we say that God is good, what does this mean? This sounds as if it means there is a category of existence called goodness, and that God has to fit into this. You see? If you say that God is all-knowing, well, this sounds like, well, there's a category of existence called the knowing beings and the non-knowing beings, and God has to fit into the knowing ones. I mean, finally, he is the most knowing, but still, he is in this category. Whereas God, in fact, as Abdu'l-Bahá explains very clearly in this tablet, precedes all categories. He generates the categories. So what is good? Good is what God decrees. That is good which God has decreed to be good. That is intelligent which God decrees or makes to be intelligent, etc., etc. In other words, all categories of existence, all attributes are generated by God. And there is no differentiation of attributes within the essence of God. So these, of course, are some very metaphysical statements. But if we think of this analogy of the sun and the rays, I think it's very clear. In other words, you can see that in the sun itself, the sun generates this pure white light. You don't see the different colors, blue and red and green, in the light itself within the sun. These attributes that are inherent in the light, they are there. It's that they're not differentiated, you understand? Abdu'l-Bahá is not saying that these attributes are not in God. He says that they're not differentiated in the level of the essence of God. We have to be very careful that not to, this is very precise terminology that's involved here. Now, Abdu'l-Bahá explains in the Tablet of the Universe, among other places, that differentiation occurs only when the attributes of God become incident in created reality. So, let's look around us at the physical world. We see different colors. We see green grass, green trees, my blue jacket, and so on. We see differentiation of colors. Now, what is the basis of this differentiation of colors? The basis is the limitation of the created world. That is, why does this jacket look blue? Why does it look blue? Physically, it looks blue for exactly the following reason. The nature of this cloth in this jacket is such that when white light is incident on the cloth absorbs all of the light except the blue. In other words, the whole spectrum of light, the red, the green, the yellow. All of that other spectrum is absorbed by this. Only the blue is reflected. And therefore, you see this as blue. The same is true for green or whatever. So things appear to be differentiated, that is blue, green, yellow, because of their limitations, because of their incapacity to reflect everything that is incident upon them. They can only reflect something of what is incident upon them. Now let's compare with a mirror. What is the logical definition of a mirror? The logical definition of a mirror is that physical substance which reflects all of the light that is incident upon it and absorbs none of the light. Okay? That's a logical definition of a mirror. I mean, we could define a mirror physically as a flat thing that's covered with mercury or whatever you want to say, okay? But there again, that would be like the featherless biped, because I could have a mirror made out of wood or a mirror made out of all sorts of things. So a mirror is, logically speaking, a physical substance which has the capacity to reflect all of the light that is incident upon it, which absorbs none of it. So, if I shine white light into a mirror, what I see reflected from the mirror is white light. In other words, the property of the mirror is to reflect everything that is incident upon it. Now, this is the human soul. This is the human soul. This is this reality of the human being, which has the capacity to reflect all of the attributes of God, that is, to reflect in some degree all of the light of God that is incident upon it. Now, I say in some degree. Of course, a perfect mirror would reflect perfectly all of the light, but we could imagine also an imperfect mirror that is not completely smooth, and so therefore it is going to refract the light in various ways. Or another analogy which Abdu'l-Bahá uses, which is very powerful, is a prism. You know that a prism, if you shine white light onto a prism, it splits the light up into the spectrum of colors. You see all the colors reflected in the prism. But each prism is an individual physical object. No two prisms will refract the light in exactly the same way. In other words, one prism would give more weight to the red part of the spectrum, and another prism more to the green part of the spectrum. So this is the individuality of our souls. In other words, every human soul reflects in some degree all of the attributes of God, but not in the same proportion. There's individuality in the way this is done. And this is like so many different prisms. So to sum up the human reality, we can say that there are two ways in which we are the same and one way in which we are different from each other. This is very clear from the writing. The first way in which we are the same is that all human souls are created of the same substance. Well, we know the hidden word which says this. Know thee, why we have created you all from the same substance, that no man shall exalt himself above his neighbor. So my soul is not made of better stuff than your soul. In other words, all our souls are made of the same substance. There's no inherent superiority in the what my soul is made out of with respect to what your soul is made out of. This is the first point of unity. The second point of unity is this defining attribute of the human being that I've been talking about, namely that the human being has the capacity to reflect all of the attributes of God. And this is clear over and over again in the writings. Every human soul has the capacity to reflect all of the attributes of God. It's not just the statement that Dr. Danish read last night. These are literally hundreds places in the writings where he repeats in different ways exactly the same thing. The human soul alone of all human realities reflects all of the attributes of God. So this again, you see, it could have been different, right? It could be that God created us so that your soul could reflect certain attributes and mine and certain others, and we could say, well, generally speaking, all of the attributes are reflected in some human being, but not necessarily in a given human being. But no, that's not the case. Every individual human soul has the capacity to reflect all of the attributes of God. However, there is a third respect in which human souls differ, and that is that the degree or proportion in which we reflect, our souls reflect these attributes, is different. This is the individual difference that is innate. And you can reread the chapter in Some Answered Questions about the causes and the difference in the character of men, where Abdu'l-Bahá makes it absolutely clear that there are innate differences in spiritual capacity. Okay? There's no doubt about this. So Abdu'l-Bahá is not a Lockean. He is not a Humean. He is not a Skinnerian. Okay? In fact, in another passage, I think it's from the Tablet of August Forel, but in any case, it's in Baha'i World Faith, Abdu'l-Bahá specifically contrasts the teachings of the prophets with that notion which was then current in science, namely that all human beings have the same capacity at the beginning, and it's only experience that makes them different. This idea goes back to Locke, into the late Renaissance psychologist Rousseau, Locke, and so on, who held this super egalitarian notion that there were no individual differences, the notion of the tabula rasa, that everybody starts out like a blank sheet on which experience writes. And Abdu'l-Bahá specifically cites this, and he says, this is the teaching of some philosophers and some psychologists, but the prophets of God know that there are innate individual differences. And so this is quite clear. And in the same passage in Some Answered Questions, Abdu'l-Bahá, and the one I referred to in the chapter on the causes of the difference in the character of human being, Abdu'l-Bahá makes it very clear. He says, if you take two children from the same family, in other words, with the same parent, eating the same food, living in the same environment, going to the same school, with the same teachers. In other words, he mentions all the genetic variables, all the social variables that you can think of. He says, if all of these are the same, he said, still you will find some who are very bright in the sciences and others who are not so able in the sciences and so on and so on. So he makes it very clear that there are innate differences. But then he goes on to make the point, which is obvious, that these differences do not imply superiority or inferiority. In other words, this is another notion which I don't want to get into now. Well, maybe I will in a few minutes, but I don't want to get directly into it. You see, we immediately react to this notion of the human being as in some sense unfair. We say that that means that God made you smart and me stupid. But you see, intelligence in science, which is Abdu'l-Bahá's example in that particular case, is just one example of a difference. In other words, suppose you are smarter than me, but I'm a better ballet dancer than you are. I mean, you could just as well feel it's not fair that God made me a better ballet dancer and you an uncoordinated oaf, you know. In other words, it is we who make these comparisons, and it is society, this competitive society we live in, which arranges these judgments into a hierarchy of values and says that those who possess certain capacities are better than others. That's not God that's doing that, you see. But we'll talk more about this later. This is very relevant to the Kitab-i Aqdas, as a matter of fact. But just let me suggest for the moment, and we can get into this later on, that the perception that there's some injustice in God's having created individual differences proceeds not from the reality of the human being, but it proceeds from an extremely limited, materialistic, distorted conception of the human being that derives from an extreme competitiveness that, for certain reasons, which I'll talk about later, has been generated by modern society, okay? Extreme individualism and extreme competitiveness. But we can refute this notion in a simply logical way in the following, that there are an infinity of attributes of God. And what Baha'u'llah says is that the proportion in which we reflect these attributes is different from each, between each individual. Like, again, the prism, two prisms, which each reflect the whole spectrum of light, but one prism will show more of the red, the other will show more of the blue. Now you come to the question, which is better, blue or red? And you see immediately that has no sense. It's just exactly like Abdu'l-Bahá's example of the garden of flowers. And which flower is better, the red or the yellow, or the one that smells one way or the one that smells the other way? Difference does not imply superiority or inferiority. This is the basic notion which the Baha'i faith teaches and which only the Baha'is have the capacity to understand at this stage in history. Nobody else understands this fact. It is so ingrained in the cultures that exist that difference immediately implies inferiority or superiority. The minute difference is perceived, the next question people ask is, which is better? Right? As soon as there's a recognition of difference, the next question people ask without even thinking whether this is an appropriate question is, okay, well, if that person is white and that person is black, well, which is better, white or black? You know, the fact that things can simply be different without being arranged in some hierarchy is simply foreign to the modern cultural notion. So I'm suggesting that this is a cultural bias which leads us to perceive these innate differences in a negative way. And this is one of the things which it will be important in coming to grips with the Kitab-i Aqdas, because the Kitab-i Aqdas is based on the reality of the human being, not on some cultural perception of the human being. It's based on the reality, as Hussein was saying last night. It is based on the reality, the full spectrum of the human reality, and it's not based on some patty cake image of the human being that has been invented by some limited group of psychologists or philosophers or anything else. And because it is based on the human reality, it is true. It is true in the quite literal scientific sense. In fact, if you'll notice the title of my article that I've given you, the subtitle is The Causality Principle in the World of Being. And this is what we will be seeing this week, is that the Kitab-i Aqdas is the counterpart for the spiritual world to science in the material world. Rick Rabiak just gives us the scientific understanding of the operation of the law of cause and effect in the spiritual world. That's exactly what the Kitab-i Aqdas does. Okay? The Kitab-i Aqdas is not a book of rules. It is not a book of convention. It is not a book of exhortations about you should be a good boy and act in such and such a way. It is telling you this is the law of cause and effect in spiritual reality. If you want to live in harmony with your reality, then this is the way to do it. If you don't want to, don't do it. God is sufficiently, is independent of his creatures. He has no need of their worship. If you don't obey the laws, of, you know, you don't want to be faithful to your wife, okay? Don't be faithful to your wife. You'll suffer. I mean, you'll louse up your marriage and so on and so on. You will suffer a humiliating torment in the next world. But if you want to do it, go ahead and do it. You know, it's not going to hurt anybody else. And so on and so on. So there it is. There it is. It is the choice sealed wine. It is the law of cause and effect in spiritual reality, which is being given to us. It is being given to us the understanding of the law of cause and effect in spiritual reality, based on the God-created reality of the human being. That's what the Kitab-i Aqdas is. And that's why it is, as Shoghi Effendi says of it, the consummation of all the holy books of the past. I quoted that passage. You know that it's in the, it's from God Passes By, and it's quoted in the introduction. Right, it's on page 204 of this. The principal repository of that law which the prophet Isaiah had anticipated and which the writer of the Apocalypse had described as the new heaven and the new earth, as the tabernacle of God, as the holy city, as the bride, the new Jerusalem coming down from God, the most holy book, whose provisions must remain inviolate for no less than 1,000 years, and whose system will embrace the entire planet, as the brightest emanation of the mind of Baha'u'llah, as the mother book of his dispensation and the charter of his new world order. So this is why the Kitab-i Aqdas has this exalted status, because it is this key to understanding the law of cause and effect in the spiritual world. Now, I begin by talking about history. Now, in the same passage on page 65 of the Gleanings that Hussein read last night, Baha'u'llah goes on to say the following thing. He says, first, alone of all created things, the human being has been singled out for this favor. And he said, then he says the following thing. He says, the purpose of God in endowing the human being with this capacity is so that the human being can know and love God. So in other words, not only did God create us this way, but there's a reason why he created us. And he created us this way so that we can know and love God. You have the Gleanings there? Is that? Yeah. Okay. Why don't you read that? Page 65, if it's the... Do you have the whole passage? But it's previous to this, just in the passage just before that.
Yes, yes, yes.
He says, it doesn't matter. What he says is, first he talks about, the passage starts out about how it is that God has created, that God has brought from utter nothingness. You found it? lucky, it's worth it. All praise to the unity of God, and all honor to him, the sovereign Lord, the incomparable and all-glorious ruler of the universe, who out of utter nothingness hath created the reality of all things. So he goes on about the greatness of God in creating. Nothing short of his all-encompassing grace, his all-pervading mercy could possibly have achieved it. Then he says, having created the world and all that liveth and moveth therein, he, through the direct and operation of his unconstrained and sovereign will, chose to confer upon man the unique distinction and capacity to know him and to love him, a capacity that must needs be regarded as the generating impulse and the primary purpose underlying the whole of creation. So, in other words, the only reason God created anything at all was so that he could create the human being, which has this capacity to know him and love him. And this capacity to know and love God is, of course, the same as this capacity to reflect all of the attributes of God. Upon the inmost reality of each and every created thing, he hath shed the light of one of his names. But upon the reality of man, he hath focused the radiance of all his names and attributes and made it a mirror of his own self. Alone of all created things hath man been singled out for so great a favor. So the purpose then in creating man was to make man a mirror of the image of God. In other words, we are created to be worthy partners in dialogue with God. Yes, you had a question. We will talk about this. When I get on Sunday night, when I give the lecture on the structure of reality, I'll talk about this. It doesn't mean absolute nothingness, because as Abdu'l-Bahá says, as Aristotle already said before Abdu'l-Bahá, and as Abdu'l-Bahá reiterates, you couldn't have anything that comes from absolute nothingness. If there was absolute nothingness, there never would be anything. And anything that exists cannot be annihilated, because you can't transform existence into absolute non-existence either. So obviously he doesn't mean, you know. But in the first place, God always existed, right? So nothing that God made came from nothing. It came from God. Okay? Doesn't mean it's made out of God, but it means it came from God. But Baha'u'llah explains how God created, actually. Okay? He started with a point. The point moved. He generated a line. He splits the line lengthwise. And then he causes the two lines to revolve around each other, which is simple harmonic motion. In other words, which generates the DNA, which generates essentially fractals. In other words, it represents an infinite repetition of certain patterns, which produces differentiated reality. But this is explained in the writings of the faith. Okay. So in a certain sense, the point is nothing, because it has no dimension, but it's still an existent reality. So we have to understand what that means. But it doesn't mean absolute nothingness, okay? It does not mean absolute nothingness. That's clear. Okay. So at least on Sunday night, those of you who are interested, we can discuss these things in much more detail. Okay. So here we see then that the purpose of God in creating man was to create a worthy partner in dialogue with himself. This is the human destiny. Therefore, history, both collective history and individual history, is a history of the dialogue between us and God. That's what history is. You want to know what history is? Marx said history was a class struggle, okay? Other historians say that history is a chaos of events. Others say that history is even the history of religion. History is the history of the dialogue between God and humanity. That's what history is. The history of every individual is the history of the dialogue between that individual and God. And the history of every culture is the history of the dialogue between that people or that culture and God. Now, just as, now, in this tablet that I mentioned that Abdu'l-Bahá wrote the commentary on, I was a hidden treasure, you need your book back. I lost my train of thought. What was I saying? He says that not only that there is differentiation of attributes in the level of creation, but he says that every human soul has a dominant attribute. That there is, God has caused one attribute to be dominant in each human being. Now, this is simply a somewhat philosophical way of saying what we already know from a common sense basis.